Good afternoon. I'll call the Monday, March 9th meeting of the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development to order. And we're going to take the agenda a little bit out of order and start with our work session. So I will open a work session on Senate Bill 213. And members, this is a bill that we heard, I believe, last week, but we did not yet have it reviewed for its no fiscal impact and no revenue impact. Now those have come back. And Jeremy, do you want to just refresh our memory about this bill?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 213 includes out-of-state and internet sellers of tobacco products to Oregon consumers under Oregon regulation. It clarifies the applicability of specific tobacco regulations to all persons and provides for a civil penalty of up to $5,000 per violation. And we now have a no revenue impact and no fiscal impact statements.
And I don't see anything. You have those in your file, it looks
like. Yes, I do.
Because we don't have anything out here.
No expenditure impact and no revenue impact.
No revenue impact. Yeah. Okay. Great. So, members, Madam Chair, I move in a work session, Senator Mona Sanderson.
I move that Senate Bill 213 be moved to the floor with due pass recommendation.
And Senator Mona Sanderson has moved Senate Bill 213 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Pam, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Aye. And let the record show that Senator George is excused and the motion carries. And Senator Mona Sanderson, would you like to carry this on the floor?
Be happy to.
Great. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 213. And next, we have an informational presentation from the Public Employee Retirement System. So, Paul Cleary, if you would like to come forward, and I think we had asked you to do just sort of a general overview of PERS, and then if you would be so kind to take any questions from the members. So please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. I'm Paul Cleary, Executive Director of PERS. We've got a handout there, kind of a PowerPoint slide without the PowerPoint manual one. And I'll just start right in on page two. PERS, of course, is an integrated system, provides retirement, death, and disability benefits, covers about 95% of all Oregon public employees. We've got about 170,000 active members, about 50,000 inactive, 105,000 retirees, and we serve about 870 public employers. We now have four major components, Tier 1, Tier 2, the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, and the Individual Account Program. We also administer a deferred compensation program called the Oregon Savings Growth Plan and a post-retirement health insurance program. That covers about 53,000 retirees. As a result of PERS reform, our board now has five members on it. We've got an employee representative, an employer representative, and then three non-affiliated members, all five of which are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. A lot of focus often on the cost of PERS, and I'll speak some to the cost side, but I also want to mention the benefit side because we are a major source of economic stimulation, if you will, here in Oregon. We pay out about $2.9 billion annually in benefits, about 85% of which go to people who reside in Oregon, so about $2.4 billion. Our average benefits about $23,300. National average is about $21,800 for public retirees. Difference of about $125 a month for Oregon. One thing that we don't do that a number of other systems do, we don't provide very much at all in terms of retiree health insurance subsidies. until you're Medicare eligible age 65, all we do under state law is require employers to allow you to stay pooled with the active members. And certainly there's a benefit to being pooled with active members. It's always good to be pooled with folks who don't know how to spell Lipitor if you do. But beyond that, at the Medicare age, we do provide, if you're eligible, I think it's 8 years of service, $60 a month for our Medicare supplement. We actually have got kind of two boards. We've got a separate entity called the Oregon Investment Council. Again, a five voting member, six member board. I'm the sixth member non-voting on the Oregon Investment Council. They oversee the PERS fund investments. They're staffed by Oregon State Treasury. Large fund, we're the 15th largest public fund in the United States and the 21st largest public or private fund in the United States. As of January 31st, we were valued at about $64 billion. Over time, our investments have generated well over 70% of our total revenue. Our funding status always goes up and down with the markets. Obviously, we were 65% funded in early 2003, grew to about 112% funded at the end of 07, and then declined to 80% funded at the end of 08.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Cleary. How does that compare with other retirement systems?
Chair Senator Sanderson, I believe we're still the best funded system in the nation. I've got a map a little bit later that shows that.
Page 15.
All relative, yeah. In terms of the average, the national average for public retirement systems was about 86% funded when we were 112, and the estimate is that they have now dropped to around 65, while we're in that 75 to 80% range.
I guess, Madam Chair, the point I wanted to make is we are doing very well compared to the rest of the nation, as far as I'm concerned, and I think that PERS has really had due diligence in making sure that we were held accountable with our funds.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Sanderson, I appreciate that. I don't think we got stupid overnight. As a matter of fact, we worked hard to get ourselves in a very good position to be able to weather this kind of a storm. We certainly didn't anticipate the storm that we've got. A 27% decline in 2008 compared to our worst history of about a 9% decline gives you an idea of the depth of it. But I think we're not alone. It's hit all public systems. It hit private defined benefit plans. It's hit individual systems as well. In terms of our membership, again, I've given you the numbers before. People often ask, what's the makeup now? And we're actually, it's interesting, we've got about 27% of our people are in the new plan, the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan. About 38% are still in Tier 1 and 35% in Tier 2. Tier 1, people who worked started work before January 1 of 1996. Tier 2, 96 up until late August of 2003. Anyone who started after late August of 2003 when the reform bills went into effect is now in the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan. We've got 55,000 members eligible to retire by age or service, and that age wave, if you will, the tidal wave on page 4 shows what our demographics look like. Of that 55,000 members, that represents about 31% of all active members are eligible to retire, and about 48% of inactive. We've been retiring about 6,000 people a year for the last 10 years. We project that to grow over the next four or so into 8,000 a year or so, and we'll probably be seeing that type of number over the next decade. Before reform, I'm on page 5. Tier 1 members, they still get the best of three benefit calculations, full formula, formula plus annuity, and money match. But money match was a system that basically doubled members' accounts at retirement, and then we amortized that account at the assumed earnings rate and paid it out over their anticipated lifespan. So several moving variables in there, all of which could affect the benefit level. Tier 1 members received high earnings in good years and were guaranteed 8% earnings in the bad years. We had double-digit earnings credited in the 1990s, and we doubled members' accounts in some situations almost twice over. The money match benefits just soared, became the predominant retirement calculation, and we weren't keeping our actuarial factors current, so we were getting hit with both benefits increasing at a faster level than we had planned for, and the payouts going out at a longer for a longer lifespan than we were reflecting in our actuarial factors. So it wasn't surprising that we started growing a pretty substantial unfunded liability, got up to $17 billion. For those of you who were around, and I believe everyone was, maybe except for Senator Telfer, you remember what 2003 was with the PERS reform bills. I believe you were probably in local government at that time, so you knew the other side of the coin, Senator. And I just give you a timeline of what happened with the reform. A lot of changes occurred in a very short time period. And then, of course, we had a major Supreme Court ruling, the Strunk ruling, and I highlight that on page 7, which upheld three of those key reforms. Keep those actuarial factors current. Member contributions now go into an individual account program, no longer grow that Tier 1 account with contributions, and also cap the earnings crediting to Tier 1 accounts at 8%. So anything above 8% we put in a reserve to have when we have to credit 8% in bad years. There were two provisions that were overturned. One of them would have outright prohibited us from crediting Tier 1 members in bad years instead of that reserving concept. That got overturned, and also the COLA freeze, cost of living adjustment freeze, got overturned. We've been implementing that Supreme Court decision as well as a related board settlement agreement and the Eugene or the Judge Lipscomb decision for the last 4 years. We had to go back in time and recredit everybody their 1999 earnings, change it from 20% to 11.33%. That was for 150,000 members. We had to then give Tier 1 members 8% for 03 and 04 that we hadn't given. The tough one's been recalculating 45,000 benefits for retirees and people who've withdrawn, and even death benefits to reflect those revised earnings. And then, of course, at the same time that we're doing that recalculation, we reinstate the cost of living adjustments. Working our way through that, I'm hoping that we will have the work on the 1999 earnings crediting completed, and hopefully the court case is completed before we reach the 10th anniversary of the 99 crediting. Well, I guess that'll be this March, so we might not. In terms of where we stand now, the post-reform PERS components, we used to be one major program, Tier 1, added a second program, Tier 2, and then two in the last 3 years. All of our members now participate in two programs, and I think this is important for people to recognize. They've got a pension plan, Tier 1, Tier 2, or OPSERP, and they've also got this defined contribution-like individual account. No guarantee on it. Invested the same as the rest of the PERS money. Gets market returns. Not subject to any kind of a match. And actually, members can while they participate in two programs, they can also have up to three different accounts because of the variable account. A couple of graphs here. I'll start on page 10. I want to kind of show you the trends that got us in trouble and how we got ourselves out of trouble, and we'll hopefully continue to improve in those trends. But you can see the three retirement calculations that I mentioned. Our full formula, that's the triangle-shaped line. Full formula, which is the diamond shape, and then money match. And we used to primarily be either a formula plus annuity or a full formula system. When we started with the real high earnings crediting in the 90s, we drove ourselves into a money match system, and all of a sudden 90% of the people are going out under money match. The only problem with that was we hadn't really pre-funded those benefits. We were pre-funding on the basis that we thought we'd pay you 50 to 60% of your final average salary. And the way retirement systems work is you try to collect people's contributions, both employer and member contributions over time, invest those contributions, and then use that money to pay the benefit. And with the idea that when a member retires, you've pre-funded that benefit. Unfortunately, when you were pre-funding at 50% of salary, and you can see on the next page, all of a sudden our 30-year people in 2000 started going out an average of 100% of salary. We hadn't collected enough money to pay those benefits, and that's where our unfunded liability started emerging. So the top line is our 30-year retirees. Only 12% of our retirees have 30 years of service. Another 8 or so have more than 30. 80% have less than 30 years of service. Indeed, our average, and you can see that as the solid line down below, our average retiree has 21 years of service and is 59 years old. So people get to retirement age before they get 30 years of service. And it's because people move in and out of public service. They come from other locations. I guess I'm an example. I've got 19 years in Wyoming's retirement system and 13 in here, and I've discovered that doesn't add up to 32 in terms of retirement systems. On page 12, we show what our investment returns have been and our earnings crediting. And you can see this is for close to a 40-year period. Our average return over that period, and I'm including the 2008 downturn of a negative 27% return, is 10.25%. But you can see a dramatic fluctuation around that average. Generally, we don't have negative returns. We've only had three years of negative returns before 2008. But you can also see that how we had to expand this chart to accommodate the 2008 negative return. Kind of got ourselves into trouble when we were crediting pretty close to what we were earning. That's a difficult thing to do long term, credit the highs and then guarantee the 8%. The next page is our earnings crediting for Tier 2 accounts and variable accounts. The gray line that starts around 96 with the boxes are Tier 2 accounts. Tier 2 gets what it earns, so you can see a lot of fluctuation there. The variable account is 100% invested in equities, and so you would expect it to have quite a bit of variability, and it does. And this year it had a particularly bad year, a 44% decline in the variable account. What's all that mean for the plan in total? This chart on page 14 is our net plan assets. I point out in 1995 we had about $19.5 billion in the PERS fund. We basically doubled that amount in a five-year period. Then we hit the downturn in 2000 through 2002, and we got down to a low of about $31 billion in September of 2002. Then we hit another five-year period, 03 through 07, where we doubled that 31. Now, I'd like to think that's a pattern that's emerging, and we're going to run into the same thing here with this downturn. But it does show that over time, while we've had downturns, we've been able to recover from those downturns. Your question, Senator Mona Sanderson, on how do we compare to other states, on page 15, this is a map that Forbes magazine put out. What they did is they took the 2007 values for all the states, year-end values, reduced the assets by 25%. Now, we lost on our regular account, our return was about 26.9%, so a little more than 25%. But the average for all public retirement systems was 26.8. So if we're from 83 down to 80 or so at the end of the year, the rest of these systems would be down similarly as well. And so, you know, I like to point out to people that it's always good to be one of the best funded systems in the nation. But there are a number of systems that are way ahead of us in terms of being challenged by this downturn. So hopefully we'll learn some things from them as well. Excuse me. So I think I've covered page 16. Again, you know, we've had this downturn. We're about 80% funded as of December 31st. That means we've got 80 cents on hand for every dollar of benefit promised, and the intention is, of course, to collect that over the next 20 years, both through additional contributions as well as earnings above 8%. Can we predict earnings above 8%? No, of course we can't, but we can look back at our history and see that over a 40-year period we did average 10.25%. Again, I think you've seen those other numbers. So where do we sit in terms of basically the overall makeup of the plan? I think the main thing that we did with PERS reform is we stabilized our liabilities. Prior to PERS reform, our liabilities were growing about twice the national average. We were growing at 10 to 12% a year in terms of liabilities. After PERS reform, we're growing about half of the national average. We're growing at about 3.5% a year. So that was a major thing that we addressed structurally with PERS reform, stabilizing the liabilities. The way we stabilized them was, of course, we diverted the contributions, member contributions, the IEP accounts, and then we also put the crediting restrictions on Tier 1 earnings. In terms of loss contingencies, on page 18, of course, we employ a very long-term investment strategy, have a diversified portfolio. Normal times, diversification helps you against losses. 2008, it seemed like we had losses in all of our asset classes. Normal times, active management gets rewarded as well. 2008, active management did worse than passive index managing. So 2008 was not a good year for us, but again, as I indicated earlier, we had a lot of company. So we amortize our unfunded liabilities over 20 years, and that allows us to see several different market cycles and take advantage of the recoveries associated with those market cycles. In order to moderate employer rates, we don't smooth assets like some systems do. So there are some systems that they won't reflect a loss, or they'll take a five-year period to reflect a loss. California CalPERS uses a 15-year period, both for losses and gains, so they drag them in on a smooth basis at the front end. What we do is we collar rates on the back end. You can't have your employer rates just fluctuate completely with investment volatility, or one year they wouldn't pay anything and the next year the rates would skyrocket. So our rates can't go up or down more than 3% of payroll as long as we're 80 to 120% funded. Outside of that, they can go up or down 6%. We're looking this year at possibly in the 2011-13 biennium, a 6% increase. So right now, in 2009-11, our rates are going to go down 3% because they're based on the good investment returns in 2006 and 2007, and then they could pop back up 6, which would put them 3 above current day levels. Obviously, we are concerned about the investment losses in 2008 and the impact on the unfunded liability, but it's important to recognize that it was still less than half of what we were in 2003 when measured as a percent of the fund assets. That's why we stopped at 80, or we were at 80% rather than 65% funded as of the end of the year.
Paul, could you explain what these employer side accounts are that are referred to in this slide?
I'd be happy to, Chair Rosenbaum. The side accounts are where pension obligation bonds and other lump sum payments by employers were deposited. So we had a number of school districts, local governments, and the state of Oregon back in the early 2000s, and some more recently, that issued pension obligation bonds. We took the proceeds of those bonds, and we keep them in a separate account because the benefits of that accrue solely to the issuer of the bond. So we can't commingle, or we can't just dump them into the overall account and lose track of them, if you will. So we keep very close track of them. And when the earnings are doing really well, the side accounts offset a pretty substantial portion of the PERS rate. I'll give you an example for the state of Oregon. The PERS rate without a side account for 2009-11, this upcoming biennium, would be somewhere around 12.5% or so. Instead, it's somewhere around 3%. Because the side account is offsetting about 9% of that. Now, there's a separate payment on the bond, and as a state agency, I'm assessed about 6% of payroll to pay off the bond. So we like to make sure, as one of my board members said, POB is just really another word for IOU, and there certainly is a lot to that. It's been a solid investment to date. It certainly has been impacted by the downturn in the market, so... This chart on page 20 kind of shows you this fluctuation in employer rates, these are the rates as of the valuation date. So there's a lag between when we set the rate and when it goes into effect. For example, that 2003 rate was what went into effect in the 05-07 biennium, and we're showing the 2007. That's the rate that'll go into effect in 07-09. Or in 09-11.
Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you explain that a little bit? Because I, in talking with the school districts, they were very concerned, you know, a few years ago regarding the increased amount that they were paying into the PERS system.
Mm-hmm.
But now what you're saying is that their rates are going down.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Mona Sanderson, their rates will go down in the upcoming biennium. In the 9/11 biennium from where they are today, because they're based on our funded status as of December 31st, 2007. We've got a lag time where we have to complete evaluation, and then we try to, of course, give employers plenty of time to work these rates into their budgets. So there's that time involved in doing evaluation, which takes us 8-10 months. And then we like to give employers another 8 months or so of advance notice.
Follow up. So, this next cycle, 07 or 09-11, is going to be a real hit. In a sense, then, in the Ways and Means process, at least with public education, that will actually be to their benefit because they will not be paying quite as much, and hopefully... Ways and Means takes that into consideration also.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Mona Sanderson, I'm sure that they do, and you know we're hoping, of course, that we're linked up with ability to pay. Our rates go down over the upcoming biennium, the 9/11 biennium, when ability to pay is going down because of the impact of the economic downturn on state and local government revenue. And then, of course, we know our rates are going to pop back up in 3 years, and we're hoping that the recovery is well underway and we're going to see ability to pay go up. But we try to emphasize to employers, and we've emphasized in our own Ways and Means subcommittee meeting, that this rate decrease is temporary. We'd love to think it's permanent, but at some point we've got to recognize these losses, and we will. So it's temporary, and we want people to take that into account and not spend it more than six times over.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
I would just point out one thing on this chart. You see the dip that we had in our employer rates between the 1987 and 98 period. If you kind of overlay that with... what was happening with our benefits in terms of money match, what we had going on was we saw the one-third of the iceberg that was sticking out of the water, but we didn't see the two-thirds that was underneath the water. We had a lot of liability growing that we weren't charging for, and so we got ourselves kind of in trouble there. That's a bad trend when your liabilities are going this way and your rates are going down. They should be matching each other. Legislative concept, you're going to hear one of these today. Our agency bill, we've only got a single bill, Senate Bill 112. We're also aware that there's a number of different stakeholder concepts. I would point out we really try to do a very comprehensive evaluation on legislation. If there's one thing we've learned, we're operating a very complex system. And we really owe it to you as the decision makers and to our board as the implementers to do a very detailed evaluation of legislative changes. And that often includes our actuary. And certainly we like to work with our stakeholder groups as well. We've got a legislative advisory committee that consists of both employer and member representatives, a balance of each, and so we try to, you know, measure three times and cut once, and you might see in our testimony on one of the bills today some caution that we're urging on a concept that we believe isn't ready to deal with this session, and our suggestion is to work on it over the interim because we know there's a huge amount of work associated with it. But this will just give you an idea of some things that we had heard about. The last two pages, I just include our maps that show where our retirement benefits are by county, and obviously for within the state of Oregon, as you would expect, the large population states, as well as the centers of higher education and state government here in Marion County are where the vast majority of the retirees are located, and the benefits initially go. I would suggest that they're probably spent in a little bit different patterns. But having spent a lot of time on the east side of the mountain when I was the director of state lands, I'm impressed by the fact that in Lake and Harney County, we're putting out around $5 million a year to retirees there, and the numbers up in Umatilla and so forth as well. So you can see we're spread all around the state. And then also we do have retirees that moved to other states, hard to believe, but we've got a number of folks that live up in Washington. I would suggest that a lot of people work or live in Washington during their active employment. I know I had some people at Water Resources that drove all the way down to Salem from Vancouver, and I know in the Portland metro area. And what we've seen, and it's not just an Oregon phenomenon, but it's around the nation, people generally tend to retire for the most part where they've lived when they were working. Even Iowa has 83% of its retirees stay in Iowa. So I think what we're really seeing in those Washington numbers is while I'm sure there may be a few people that move over there, I suspect the vast majority lived there while they were working here.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Yeah. Senator Amanda Sanderson.
I know a lot of families, and I mean a lot of families since live in Gresham, right, mm-hmm. very close to Washington, that move after they retired, they actually moved to Washington. Mm-hmm. And their PERS retirees, and they did it because they would avoid the income tax. And to me, I think that's sad because that's revenue that really they earned it in Oregon, and that revenue should be coming back to pay for the services that we put into their retirement system. And I don't, there's probably no way we can get around that, but it sure would be nice to tap some of that money if they had actually worked in Oregon, but then they moved away to avoid paying taxes.
Right. Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Moe Sanderson, certainly it I'm sure it does work in that direction. I think it works in both directions, though, as well, because I'm sure we've got a lot of California retirees that have moved up to Oregon that are paying their income tax on that. And Wyoming is a non-income tax state, but Oregon will collect income tax on my retirement from Wyoming. So it does tend to work both directions.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a great idea, Senator Monis Anderson. In fact, California did it, and federal government came out and it's illegal to do it. It's a great idea, but unfortunately,
I know it is.
As is often the case. And then, of course, I'd like to try to close with some good news, and I think one of the areas that we've got some good news in is our customer satisfaction surveys. Of course, we do these before we send out the annual statements, so I'm not sure what it'll look like after this year, but we've seen really good trends in our customer satisfaction over the last 3 years, both for members, retirees, as well as our employers. Employers rate us a little bit lower than the members, but even there,
We had positive trends. We had some system performance issues, our IT system performance issues this summer when we were doing the survey, and I'd advise that you don't want to have a slowdown on your website where reporters have to report their payroll through if you're doing a survey. I'm pleased to see the response that we've gotten at the staff level. We truly have, I believe, become better, faster, and cheaper, and that's the trend that we want to stay on. So with that, Madam Chair, I think I've given you an overview of the system and a little bit about the agency, and be happy to answer any other questions.
So are there other questions for Mr. Cleary? I wanted to ask you if you have seen what kind of investor behaviors you've seen among PERS active members, that there are certain portions of their accounts that they can direct, and I would assume they're having the same hysteria as just the general public in terms of trying to protect their nest egg.
Right.
So are you seeing a lot of moving around in those funds, or...?
Chair Rosenbaum, in the PERS system itself, the one thing that members can still do if they're eligible, they have to be over age 50, is transfer out of the variable account. And they can move out of the 100% equity into the more diversified portfolio. And we certainly saw a large increase in requests for the forms to do the transfers. I haven't seen the numbers yet. We're still processing those. And I would expect we'll see a spike up. But like everyone else, when you do that, you lock in whatever losses you've got in those accounts. The one place, maybe turn into our Oregon Savings Growth Plan, which is a deferred compensation plan. We've got about 24,000 members in that. That's all self-directed with a number of different options, and we are seeing people move out of the equity arenas into the stable value fund there. Again, though, it's one where once you do it, you lock in your losses. And I suspect, while I don't have the age-based evidence on this, but I would suspect anecdotally that you're seeing people closer to retirement getting more conservative in that area.
And in that case, are those self-directed funds, can they change their investment allocation electronically, or do they have to do that by filling out a form also?
Madam Chair, this is a fund that is invested those monies are invested separately from the PERS fund, and they're actually valued on a daily basis, so they can do that moving on a daily basis electronically. The PERS fund, because of some of our investments, are like our real estate investment and our private equity investment, those are valued on a quarterly basis. The closest we can come to is a monthly unit value, and even that's got some that are with a quarter lag in it. So we don't, there isn't any self-direction of money on a daily basis in the PERS fund. We do annual crediting. Now, that one of the advantages of annual crediting is it allows us to take care of prior period adjustments. If an employer wasn't aware that somebody had reached their 600 hours because they were in concurrent employment, a substitute teacher working for three different districts, and they needed to start making contributions on them 2 months ago, because of the annual crediting, they can get that money in, and we can actually credit it with the earnings, or in this case, the losses, for the entire year.
Okay. Well, seeing no other questions, I think if you want to just stay put, you're our first witness on the next bill. So
Okay. Thank
you very much for that very informative presentation.
Thank you.
And next, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 112. And members, you should have materials on Senate Bill 112 in front of you, and Jeremy, would you please tell us what this bill does?
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 112 allows certain retired members of the public employees retirement system who elected to receive a lump sum payment of benefits to be reemployed by a public employer, subject to limitations on the number of hours of employment, without repayment of the lump sum received.
And it looks like our first witness is Paul Cleary. So please go ahead, Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, Paul Cleary, Executive Director of PERS. This is the one bill that was introduced by the governor at the request of the Public Employee Retirement Board. It's our sole concept this session. And what we're trying to address here is an inconsistency in the statute, what we believe was an inadvertent inconsistency in the statute, where if you retire and receive a monthly benefit, and the vast majority of our members do receive monthly benefits, you can return to work and work up to 1,039 hours, and there's no problems, which is basically being able to work half-time in a calendar year. That's been in place for a number of years. In 2001, and I believe it became effective 2003, the legislature added a double lump sum option where members can withdraw their account and an employer match, and they don't fall under that exception that allows them to work half time. Indeed, what we did is we searched the statutes and found a way to basically say you can work 600 hours. But we want to clarify that as well, because some people could argue, no, they're not allowed to work at all. But we believe they can work at least 600 hours. The common knowledge, or the standard, the gold standard, if you will, that everybody thinks of is 1039, and we've ended up with a number of members, double lump sum, rolled the money out, gave it to, invested in another account, and certainly have had some market impacts in that account, likely, and then exceeded their 600 hours, we then have to tell them, you have to unretire, and you have to pay us back. And then when you re-retire a second time, we'll give you all that money back, minus or plus or minus whatever we do in the interim. But you can see what we're trying to do with this bill is just basically have consistent treatment for people no matter what option they retired under. We've got some numbers here. These are the total number of people who've retired under a lump sum option since it became available, and the total number who returned for some employment. We had a significant increase in people who took double lump sums in the in reaction to the, or right before the reforms came into effect. And I think a lot of people left earlier than they were anticipating, and so there was a high incidence of people returning to work as well during that time period. I asked staff to run some numbers for 2008, and in 2008 we had about 5,500 retirees working 1,039 hours or less. Now, to give you an idea, we've got a retiree base that's receiving monthly benefits of about 105,000 people. So somewhere around 5 to 6% are returning to work under that 10%, or under that 1,039 hours or less. Then we had, and this is somewhat related to this bill, you may hear some amendments to it. We had about 800 people who worked more than 1039 under the various exceptions that the legislature has provided over time. So a total of about 6,300 people. Lump sum retirees who returned to work, again, about 5% of those. So it's about a similar number of people that are returning to work after retiring, no matter what option they took. So the intent of this bill is to apply this common, more commonly understood 1039 hours limit to everyone, and hopefully reduce the potential for confusion among our members. We are aware, Senator, that there may be some amendments proposed on this, and I can tell you we discussed with our board this general issue of people returning to work after retiring. Over time, we've added a number of exceptions to that 1039 standard, and the board last session kind of adopted some principles where they'd say, okay, we generally we're concerned about this, about people returning to work and exceeding the 1039 hours, basically working full time. But if you do it in a manner where it's a limited number of people, it's based on some kind of a documented workforce shortage or special situation, and it's got a sunset in it with a reasonable time frame on it, then, you know, the board certainly understood this is an employer prerogative, and there's going to be cases where, in critical positions, there's a need to hire a retiree for more than half-time. So I know there'll be some amendments offered at some point. I'm not sure whether any of them are prepared for a work session, but I just want to make you aware of that.
Thank you.
Thank you. And members, we do have two amendments that are stapled to the back of your staff measure summary, as well as it looks like several pieces of written testimony that I assume came in directly through the committee administrator.
Yes.
So we're not planning to do a work session on this bill today, but we may be hearing from some other witnesses about their ideas.
Can we be pleased to?
Amendments. Yes. Senator Telford, please go ahead.
One question before you leave.
Okay.
You mentioned you're generally against retired people coming back into the system. What was the original intent of the payback process? I mean, go back in years, and why do we have that to begin with? What was the original intent, and therefore, why are you concerned about people coming back?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Telfer, obviously, you start off as a retirement system, and you're designed to primarily retire people. And then there was a prohibition from people kind of retiring in place. And some of it's tied to our federal tax qualification. There's got to be a bona fide retirement because what we do is, of course, we collect and invest money on a tax-deferred basis. And then the taxes are paid when the benefits are paid out. So there's a huge federal tax advantage to the design of our system, and the federal government, the IRS, wants to make sure it truly is a retirement system and it's not just some kind of deferred compensation plan where people can continue to work and never retire. So they want to see bona fide separations. Once they see bona fide separations, they understand that people could go to work for another state, they could go to work in the private sector, they could go to work all over the place and be a retiree who's back and employed. They like to see the systems at least have some kind of restriction around it, and I suspect that's where it originally got started. And so we originally were, I think, 600 hours was the maximum for anybody, and then it went to 1039 hours, and then it went to 1039 with exceptions for certain people that were in these kind of categories, and that's where we are today. And longer term, you know, if you ask my staff, some of them would like to say, let's get out of the business completely. As long as there's a bona fide separation, what do we care? It's an employer issue. Our actuary says once you get into some large numbers, you can have some pretty significant impacts. And so that's where, again, we don't think we're there. Well, we know we're not there yet, and we don't think any of the amendments, at least any amendments that any people have talked with us, trigger that. But we are aware of some bills that would provide a much larger group of people the opportunity to work unlimited hours, and that's where we could start seeing some impacts.
But once again, the bill, not the amendments, essentially just applies the same
hour standard,
threshold,
yeah.
Whether
yeah.
you retire under a lump sum
yeah.
or with a monthly benefit.
Right, Chair Rosenbaum. And we don't expect that this would trigger any real differences in retirement behaviors or selection of the option. We're just trying to eliminate some confusion that doesn't really add any value and create some real problems for a few individuals.
Okay, any other questions for Mr. Clary? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Next witness signed up is Dale Penn.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dale Penn, Director of the Oregon Lottery. I am here to talk about a proposed amendment to the bill. As Paul Cleary testified, there are a number of exceptions for this limitation of being rehired and the number of hours you could work. And if you look at those exceptions, some of the first ones are trying to be able to have law enforcement in Eastern Oregon and some hiring challenges in staffing a department geographically. At the lottery, security is our number one priority in all of our games. If players do not believe that security is strong and they have doubts on the integrity of those games, we will lose our players, we'll lose our revenue. And so security is very important to us. A statute mandates that we hire and do a contract for security services with the Oregon State Police. So we're now limiting whom we may hire for security services, which is fine. I think that's a good statute, and that's been a very good history of security over the years. We have approximately 15 positions, detective positions, that are stationed throughout the state, covering the entire state, and we have cases that the most simple ones are cut and paste forgeries of lottery tickets to very complex statewide, even international or national-wide scams involving gambling and lottery products. And so it is important for us to maintain that capability. We have had a very difficult time in keeping staff in our positions. And in the past year or so, the Oregon State Police have hired over 130 troopers. None of those troopers have volunteered for lottery service. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Maybe the most important, I know I was in law enforcement for a lot of years, and a new police officer is thinking about working on murder cases and rape cases and violent crime and arresting people and making a difference right away. The lottery is more of a white-collar crime investigative type assignment, and we simply haven't been able to attract people. Now, the difficulty with that is we have about 6 to 8 of our 15 staff are at retirement age now. And so this could create a major problem for us. What we're asking is a very narrow exception. As I said, the total number of positions are 15. We would see this be active no more than 4 or 5 at the most at any given time. And the process would allow us, first of all, we would publicize that opening throughout all active Oregon State Police officers, which is what we've done in the past. If there are no takers for that assignment, this exception would then allow us to also go to retired sworn Oregon State Police officers to fill our position. So that's our need. It's very limited. We know of no opposition to this. Certainly it's supported by Oregon State Police management. They've discussed this with the State Police Officers Association. I don't know of anyone opposed to it. We think it's very narrow, and it would allow us to maintain the capability of our security component for the Oregon State Lottery. So that's my request.
And members, it looks like this is testimony in support of the Dash 2 amendments, which the members do have in front of them. Members, any questions for Mr. Penn? Yes, Senator Pruszynski.
I've got two things. Dale, thank you for your kind of historical perspective. I'm wondering, not remembering, why we put in the limitation to just be security from OSP as compared to knowing that, like you're saying, that it's very technical, white collar. I would assume that there are people that are also Oregon sworn officers, such as out of the major metro departments that might be able to fill those type of niches that actually have a lot of experience there. And maybe even, you know, if you wanted to get outside of the Oregon sworn Federal Bureau investigators and stuff like that. Can you give us any history as to why it was limited just to OSP?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Pruszynski, I do know it would require us to change another statute that says we should contract with Oregon State Police for our security services. Mm-hmm. certainly make a good point. There are other retired officers or from other agencies that could fit this. It's just that unwrapping that entire security framework.
Yeah, I understand that. I just was wondering if there's, I just don't remember what the history was. The other thing I would just want to call to the, I guess, committee's attention and also to Dell's, the dash twos, when I look at that versus the dash threes, the dash threes actually incorporate part of what is in the dash twos, but the part that you're most interested in, which are lines 4 through 6 on dash two, is not included in the dash threes. So it seems to me that we, if we are going to move forward in keeping this perspective, even though some of the dash twos are picked up in dash threes, we would need both of them, unless there's some magic language that's embedded in the dash threes that does not make the specific reference that the dash twos do.
And Madam Chair, I would simply say, and Senator Brzezinski, I have not seen the printed dash amendments. I did talk to legislative counsel, and I know that they drafted something, and maybe that was the dash twos. There was an emergency clause in some language that related to our change.
Yeah.
And we really have a one-sentence change is all that we're requesting.
And actually, Senator Brzezinski, I don't see the change in the dash twos incorporated in the dash threes. I think these were independently requested.
So. I think they were, but sometimes it could be that maybe what is being stated explicitly in the dash twos, when the dash threes were drafted, it could possibly somehow picked up what might be within the lines 3 through 15, but I don't think so. It does seem to me that if we're going to move forward on this bill and these amendments, that we'll need to either adopt them both or have these consolidated into a subsequent amendment.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Montes Anderson.
Would you be opposed, since every exception that we have made, I'm pretty sure we've always put a sunset on it. I'm referring to the nurses. Would you be opposed to a sunset?
Madam Chair and Senator Montes Anderson, no. I certainly, we anticipate this is a problem now and will continue for a period of time, but a sunset, the capability to have the exception would be the most important part.
Yes, Senator Telfer, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know the statute, the ORS, states that we need to hire OSP for the lottery?
Madam Chair and Senator Telfer, I don't have that with me. I could certainly send it to you.
That'd be great.
And I would say that I believe it was developed at the time of the creation of the lottery simply to put some organizational structure there, saying we want to have an independent law enforcement agency, which for police services would be Oregon State Police, involved in the lottery. So I think it was an organizational issue at the very beginning of the lottery.
And are these full-time jobs that we're talking about then?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's what this amendment would allow. So, these are full-time detectives doing law enforcement work and primarily lottery investigations, but they're doing some other things, site visits, background investigations as well on people who are selling and their methods of selling and that type of thing, but they have these criminal investigations that are a main part of their duties.
So right now, you have to have experience with the Oregon State Police in order to even apply for one
employed.
Of these jobs?
You have to be actually employed.
You have to be employed as an Oregon State
Yes, Madam Chair. So we do a contract state police, and we have 15 slots, and those are Oregon State Troopers sworn individuals as employees of state police. We pay through the state police their salary, but they are employees of the Oregon State Police.
I see. So basically the change would be, I mean, these, instead of using active employees, if you didn't have enough active employees who wanted this as their service, it would then be opened up to retired state troopers.
Yes, Madam Chair. And we would first attempt to fill these positions through the active service. This would only be the secondary option.
And of these 15 positions, how many of them are unfilled right now?
We only have one that's unfilled. We've been able to change district locations because there is a geographical element. I don't want to move to take this job when I'm already working where I live. And so that's one of the criteria that happens. But we've been able to keep them together except for one at the present time. But it has been very, very difficult with no takers out of all of these new employees.
Senator Przanski.
Madam Chair, the reason I asked the question I did is because I'm not saying this is when we do it, but it may be something during the interim that we may want to look at, because I think the Chair is figuring this out. We have potentially 15 active sworn officers for OSP that are assigned to lottery that could be actually doing OSP work. Not that this isn't important, but I think there's enough qualified people, individuals, that if you actually allowed some that are either, let's say, retired and coming back, or if the lottery had the authority to actually hire other sworn officers with these skill sets, they would be able to do that. But, I mean, that's part of the policy philosophy issues, and we would have to open the door and look at some point.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Przanski, the one thing I would put in there, because since you are discussing finances, is, yeah, there's 15 slots there, but they are totally unsupported by the general fund. So if you want to move them in the general fund, then it would be an addition, whether you added that to the state police budget. But it would be just like saying you're going to increase the Oregon State Police budget to have 15.
Seems like everyone in the room is in agreement with these wild thoughts that we have every once in a while. Always have to look outside of the box just to see what's on the other side of the box, Mary.
Okay. Thank you
very much
for your testimony. And next, we'll call Mary Botkin.
Just need to see who's awake in the room, who's not.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I drew the short straw today for the PERS Coalition. And, you know, there is there's sometimes a great advantage to white hair, as you know, Senator Przanski. There are other times when the advantage is not quite so clear. Today, one of the advantages is that I was actually in the building, and I think you were too, when the lottery was initially established. And as if you will recall, there was significant opposition from some of the religious community, and concerns were raised. And as I recall, and Ellen Lowe is actually still in the building as well, and she was one of the most vocal opponents of the lottery and of any kind of formalized gambling as a way to fund services. But I believe that the utilization of state police was one of the trade-offs originally made to sort of quiet the uproar over the lottery, and the fact that they wanted sworn law enforcement officers who are not in any way connected with gambling interests, if you will. So, be that as it may, that's not why we're here today. The bill before you is yet another exception, and the PERS Coalition has actually had a fairly lengthy discussion about all of these exceptions. And with unemployment at plus 9 and rising, I find it hard to believe we can't find qualified people to fill jobs that retirees are now filling. But we will let that just sort of sit there, because at this point what the PERS Coalition really would like is for everybody to kind of take a step back, reexamine why we did the exceptions to begin with, and to establish some hurdles before we just bring folks back into the workforce that are retired. A good example of an agency who has done this in the way that we thought it should be done is the Oregon Youth Authority, who went out on a national search to find a director to fill the spot of retired Bobby Mink. after an exhaustive national search, two individuals were interviewed, neither of which gained the support of either the management or the labor side of the interview team. And in fact, upon more closer scrutiny, both were found to be lacking in ability to run an agency the size of OYA. At that point, the governor's office and his staff, Joe O'Leary, approached us and asked us if we would support a small amendment that would allow Bobby Mink to continue in that position as the director until such time as a qualified replacement could be found. And since we were part of the whole process and we sort of saw what happened, it felt okay to both us and our OPEU counterparts or SEIU counterparts to, you know, say that this is a good exception for now. And the governor's office has put a sunset on that exception, as we think is appropriate. What bothers us is when we find that there are over 6,000 retirees in the workforce working full-time. We have some information, though it's not been verified, that we have an Eastern Oregon school district that has no new teachers in it, but that they are all retirees who are retired and come back to work. We find this double dipping to be a phenomena that is not what we intended. It is not what we believe the legislature intended when they began to draw some exceptions and to allow some return to work, but rather a reluctance to properly recruit and retrain or train and find new people to fill those spots. We think that when you retire, you should retire. That job should go to somebody who doesn't have a job. That's what a career is about. It is a beginning and an end. And our effort has always been to make sure that PERS provided for a dignified retirement. We believe it does that. You know, there's always room for improvement, but generally speaking, we think that PERS provides for a good retirement for people, a fair retirement, and that those jobs need to be opened up to the next generation of workers, whether they're nurses or cops or firefighters or teachers or corrections officers or secretaries. If we don't make room for the new workforce, then where are they going to work? There is a limit at some point. And, you know, we need to make sure that everybody has a chance to build a career, not just a few. And so at this point, we're asking that everybody just sort of take a breath and take a step back a minute, and let's really think about what it is we're trying to accomplish. And if there is expertise that a retiree brings into the workforce, then rehire them for a short period of time to share that expertise, or plan ahead so that the expertise can be shared prior to retirement. But don't just continue to employ the same person on Friday as a regular status employee and on Monday as a retiree. That makes no sense to us. And so we'd like to rethink this whole thing until we can figure out what we're doing and why we're doing it and what the parameters are and rebuild those walls so that it makes some sense.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Ms. Buck?
Yes,
Senator Monica Anderson.
Let's just take the nurse. We had a nurse shortage. I can't remember if you were in favor of that exception or not. You were. Okay.
And I do think we've had a nurse shortage, and I think we're trying to address that. And if we have a nurse shortage at St. Vincent's, come on over to the state hospital with me. Okay, I mean, there have been problems, and I think that part of the problem is we have to look at why there is a nurse shortage. If there is a nurse shortage at the state hospital because it's a violent work environment and because people are going to get hurt and maimed, then maybe we should take a look at a way to fix the environment, which is what we're doing now. We're working with management to make it a safer environment. That's part of our problem. If it's a nurse shortage because people aren't graduating quickly enough, or because the nursing schools are too full, then we need to take a look and see what do we need to do to expand those opportunities. And I think we've done that as well. And Senator, you've been very helpful in sort of identifying ways to do that. And I think those are the things we need to look at. If there is a shortage of state police officers to do lottery work, then certainly we would look at expanding that language to cover county sheriffs and sworn deputy sheriffs. I think that the question and the integrity of the original arrangements that were made are important. I mean, we made a deal with people to do a certain thing. And I don't think it was a bad deal, but maybe it was too limited. Maybe we needed to expand it a little bit. There are officers who will be losing their jobs soon because of the budget shortfalls. You know, I got a hunch they'd be willing to work at the lottery. If there's a limitation because of the state police limitation, then let's expand it beyond that. But to just bring in retirees without thinking about other ways to do it doesn't make sense to me either. And maybe it ends up making sense, but it doesn't today.
And so to get back to the original bill, because we've been talking about the amendments, my reading of the bill, though, is that it doesn't actually try to expand the use of PERS retirees. It just tries to streamline or sort of make consistent the hours threshold if you took your PERS as a lump sum versus you took it as a monthly benefit. And I understand maybe you don't agree with the idea that we let people work any hours at all, but do you think it makes sense to have uniform terms for those two classes of retirees?
Madam Chair, thank you for bringing this sort of back onto the focus of the bill. I think for the administration of PERS, I think it makes sense to make the two classes equal. Then I think we have to have a discussion about how we treat the exceptions to those, to the 1039 rule. You know, there are people who want to remove it completely. There are people who don't. There are people like me who don't want to remove it at all, except exception by exception. But I think somewhere in the middle there's probably some common ground. And I think with a little effort, employers can show what OIA did, which is we do have a problem. We need your help to solve the problem. But for the purposes of this bill, the PERS Coalition had no problem with this bill until the amendments started coming in.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Pazansky.
So, Mary, just I want to correct the record if it's wrong, because the email that's attached as part of the dash threes, which would be allowing Bobby Mink to be hired under these criteria, gives me the impression that you and the organization are in support of that. Has that changed?
Of the change with the for OIA mm-hmm. with a sunset.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I'm sorry if I was confusing on that.
Understand, I just want to make sure the record's straight.
Right.
I understand your bigger picture as you're looking at, but for this exception, since
for this exception, we are fine with the efforts that OIA has made,
right,
and with the limitations they have found themselves with, and we certainly don't want OIA to go headless for a while.
No, we don't. Been there, done that.
Yes, been there, done that, and Bobby Mink is doing a fine job over there, and we'd like him to continue to do it until we can find somebody of equal value.
Thank you, Senator Pazansky, for that clarification. And thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 112?
Looks like Mr. O'Leary wants to speak probably about the dash threes. I just have this vision.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Joe O'Leary. I'm Governor Kulongoski's public safety advisor. I have yet to see, I believe it's the Dash 3 amendment based on what Senator Pazansky indicated, but it is an amendment that the governor asked me to pursue. As Ms. Botkin referenced, following a national recruitment for the new director of the Oregon Youth Authority, Bobby Mink was placed in that position as the interim director of the Oregon Youth Authority in September of 2008, following the resignation of Bob Jester. And we had every intention and Bobby at the time had every intention of going back to retirement, and we had every intention of hiring the right person to fill that position on a permanent basis, and we had 30 applicants respond to the recruitment. That was culled down to three who were invited to come to Oregon to participate in two stakeholder panels. One, referenced by Ms. Botkin, was a labor management stakeholder panel, internal OIA panel, and the other was an external panel that was made up of several of the members of the Oregon Youth Authority Advisory Committee, which include juvenile department directors, judges, prosecutors, victims, treatment providers, et cetera. And the consensus of those two panels, and I should add, I mentioned we had three candidates. One was from consideration when he found out that there was a public process for the next step. That left us with the two candidates who went through that process and who were not found to be acceptable candidates at this time for the director position. So in response to that, I sought the amendment that I believe is the Dash 3 that is intended to carve out an exception specific to the director of the Oregon Youth Authority, in this case the interim director, Bobby Mink, and it would sunset I believe in 3 years, providing the flexibility for Bobby to continue for the next two and then to transition out under the next governor. Just for purposes of the record, as Mary has already represented on behalf of AFSCME, that represents the staff of the Oregon Youth Authority. The other union that represents the staff of the Oregon Youth Authority is the Service Employees International Union. I have provided you individually with a letter from SEIU voicing its support. Also a letter from the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs, again for the record, which is the Association of Treatment Providers that contract with OIA, the Coalition of Advocates for Equal Justice for Girls, and its president, Pam Patton, criminal defense attorney Kathy Berger, who was formerly with the Juvenile Rights Project and is on OIA's advisory committee, and a letter from Steve Dole of Crime Victims United. I also have been given authorization to convey the verbal support of Chief Juvenile Court Judge in Multnomah County, Nan Waller, as well as the incoming president of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, Lane County Juvenile Department Director, Lisa Smith.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Przanski.
Joe, just want to clarify, I understand you're correct, the amendment does have a sunset, or it repeals itself on January 2nd of 2012. So is it your understanding that if this amendment is adopted and it is passed in law, Mr. Mink would be retained in the position as the director, and at some point we're going to start looking for someone to replace him, but is it going to be waiting until the next governor is he or she is actually on board before that occurs, or are we going to start before that?
Senator Rosenbaum, Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Przanski, I do not know the answer to that question yet.
Okay.
We have not progressed, the candid answer is we have not progressed far enough in our determination to really answer that. The truth is that right here, right now, we have a crisis, Bobby, his hours, my understanding, his hours are going to run out in May, and this agency cannot afford to not have a leader.
Any other questions for Mr. O'Leary? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 112? Seeing no one, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 112. And members, I do not plan to take this up in work session today, but I will be talking to you further about it, and we will probably be taking this up possibly as early as next week. So we have one bill remaining on our agenda for today, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 399 and call Paul Clary. Please come forward.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jeremy. Please tell us about this bill.
Madam Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 399 permits certain members of the public employee's retirement system who participate in deferred compensation plans to direct deferred compensation to PERS within 60 days of the effective date of the Act in order to restore forfeited creditable service or acquire retirement credit for probationary periods of employment. We have no revenue impact, and there is no fiscal impact statement as of yet.
Okay, welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, again, Paul Clary, Executive Director of PERS. We appreciate the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 399. PERS statute currently allows a number of different types of purchases to occur, but there's a standard proviso that all of them occur within 90 days of retirement. And those purchases could be the two that this bill covers. We refer to them kind of as the waiting time, that six-month probationary period, the refunded time when someone's withdrawn and taken their account out and then comes back to employment. We've got police and fire units. We've got military time. We've got teaching time. We've got time that's that was served in other states for police and fire, non-PERS police and fire. Give you an idea of the number of purchases. In 2008, we had 2,416 purchases. Vast majority are waiting time. Almost 1,900 of that are waiting time. About 450 refunded time purchases as well. This bill, which isn't a PERS bill, but causes us concern, would only affect two of those purchases, the waiting time and the refunded time, and would allow members to do this purchase outside of that 90-day window. And it's very limited in scope because you have to be in the state deferred compensation program, the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. Couldn't be from another tax deferred account of an IRA or your 401k if you came from the private sector. And also, it's specific to only people with 30 years of creditable service before the purchase is made, or the purchase would get them to 30 years as well. So we look at this as a narrowly constrained bill that you know, we're not really sure what the principle is to constrain it so narrowly. We know that from a operational standpoint, even as narrowly constrained, we can't handle this bill because our current IT system, which we're going through a $30 million conversion on now, hasn't been programmed to handle these kind of purchases on a pre-tax basis, and it's because we've got to keep track of that for the rest of time in terms of when we pay out the benefits, because at some point there'll be taxes that'll have to be paid on this money. And so our suggestion on this bill is both because we don't really understand the principle, we think it's probably over narrowly confined, and it from an operational standpoint, we couldn't even handle it for the next biennium. Our suggestion is that we defer this to a interim study. We look at expanding it. If it's a good idea for a certain group of people, maybe it's a good idea for everyone. We're not sure that you need to do any of these prior to 90 days before retirement. Indeed, most systems, that's all they limit. They only allow you to make purchases in those kind of time frames. By deferring it would allow us to look at the actuarial impacts of these purchases. Anytime you've got a purchase that isn't a full cost purchase, there can be some increased cost to employers. We'd want to tease that apart entirely, and also it would allow us to complete this RIMS conversion project and then prepare for the IT system changes that would be required to accommodate this bill. So again, our recommendation is to defer action on this bill, allow us to evaluate it fully during the interim, And then if it looks like it's a good idea, bring it back on a more expanded basis in the next session when actually we could actually implement it as well.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. No one else has signed up to testify on Senate Bill 399. Is there anybody else who would like to testify? Please come forward. Good afternoon, and if you could... Great, it looks like you have written testimony. So whichever of you has decided to go first, please go ahead and please identify yourself for the record.
Sure. You want me to start? Yeah, go ahead. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark Hunt, currently a retiree, and do appreciate the benefits that PERS has offered. I spent just short of 33 years with the state government and enjoyed it immensely. Unfortunately, the market as it was caused my earlier departure, and I miss it sometimes. The question that we want to bring before you, members of the committee, is really a public policy issue. And that public policy issue can be distilled down as simply as, is it appropriate that we have an administrative system that provides a double taxation of benefits for members? It does not expand the benefits that would otherwise be available to members that choose to retire. It simply tries to remove the hurdle, if you will, or the burden of a double taxation where members that wish to buy back time have to pay that buyback time with post-tax earnings. I appreciate the comments that Mr. O'Leary, shared with us because, frankly, some of the limitations were actually advisory from the Ledge Council person that I talked with. We think that it is good public policy and would like to see it expanded. However, this is, I think, the third session that some idea like this has come forward. And so I think I'd be concerned with continuing to evaluate and refine it. At some point, I would like to get that public discussion going in regards to the policy. So what you have before you is a handout that we've tried to walk through some examples, and you will see that the examples there, it doesn't take a very large dollar amount that you need to buy back over the course of a person's career to become a very large number. And then when you look at the federal taxes as well as the penalty that is associated with having to withdraw monies out of another retirement account so you can pay off this are pretty substantial. And that's really a part of the public policy. It isn't our intention to come forward and seek additional or new benefits. It's simply to remove the administrative burden of a double taxation. It is my understanding from some staff committee work that there are 31 or 34 states that currently allow this. The federal tax laws also allow this kind of transfer. And I guess as a recent retiree, I can also appreciate the current process allows for an individual to move their money out of PERS and into another retirement account without suffering any tax penalty or liability. So there's the mechanism already in place to go out of, for example, your Oregon Savings Growth Plan or your PERS account if you choose to take a lump sum. But and there's also the mechanism coming in when you write a check to buy your time back or to buy the waiting period. We're not hung up on the waiting period specifically. Our focus that we're trying to zero in on is the administrative double taxation that we see. So with that, I'll... Mr. Craig.
Okay.
Thank you. My name is Tom Perry. I am currently a state employee. I'd like to call your attention to there are five qualifying conditions we've listed here under this bill. A couple of them have been identified as being exclusionary. The 30-year having combined service, creditable service of at least 30 years after the buyback, and the fairly narrowly constructed 60-day window, we agree that those are exclusionary. It is our recommendation to eliminate the 30-year combined service period and to replace the what we consider an exclusionary 60-day window with what Mr. Cleary recommended to make the window within 90 days of retirement as provided by current law. As Mr. Hunt mentioned, this issue has come up several times before. In the 2005 session, House Bill 3410 was drafted at my request by Representative Berger. I was unable to get that scheduled for a hearing, and it died. This issue has been discussed in other forums. So the concept has been contemplated for quite a while. Mr. Hunt also mentioned the issue that you can transfer money out from PERS into a deferred comp plan, and as a layman, it's hard for me to understand why, with a little tweaking, the system couldn't also transfer that money from one place back in, from deferred comp back in. I'm also aware that PERS must account separately for monies coming in, whether it be a check written for a refunded time or waiting time. So that mechanism for separate accounting, we believe, also is in place. What we are looking for, what we think is good public policy, is to establish a reasonable date certain for something like this to occur. And by reasonable, I mean something within the reasonable near future, a year or two at the most, not into the subsequent 2011-2013 biennium. We are aware that there is a significant IT project underway, as I understand it's between $25 and $30 million. And as a layman, it's difficult for me to understand why that couldn't, this concept could not be folded into that project. We have a current tax example. I computed this, and I must admit I'm a little bit rusty on some of my tax computations, but the issue for me is that they shouldn't have a 46 or 50% tax penalty, a tax payment up front to buy back your time. That money, as I understand, the money that is goes into the system will be, a proportion of that will be given back to you as a tax-free, benefit, a little bit of a refund. That proportion, from the one example that I'm aware of, is about between 2.5% and 3% per year. So to recover the full dollar amount, you have to live beyond your retirement date in excess of 30 years. And in addition, the time value of money is going to diminish the amount of money that you return back to you to well below the amount that you had to pay in. So with the suggestions for amendments that we have, we believe that allowing this tax-free rollover into PERS to buy for these limited purposes of buying back refunded time and waiting time, we believe that is good public policy, and we would like to see it proceed further.
Okay, thank you both for your testimony. Any questions for these witnesses? Senator Manus Anderson.
Did you say you had amendments for this?
We have suggestions.
Oh, but we don't have them in front of us.
No.
I think to say that the amendments that we'd be interested would perhaps meet some of the concerns that were expressed earlier.
Okay. Looks like you've answered all of our questions. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you for your time.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 399? Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 399. And with nothing further to come before us today, members, we are adjourned.